Your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
You've probably heard a lot of advice about how to manage your time better, time management, avoid procrastination. And yet it is a critical topic, and so I set myself a challenge today. Can I come up with some tactics that are not so obvious that are actually likely to help you with your time? You know, at the risk of being a little hyperbolic, that may even help you reap a life and a half from a life. So I want to start by talking about a couple of prerequisites. Normally you talk about these time management tactics, but many people don't care enough to manage their time well because they feel it's not going to make a difference. They feel like, okay, you know, my job stinks. I have no relationships. Nobody cares about me. I have no money. I'll never save enough for retirement. What difference does it make? Let me just hang out. So prerequisite to even caring a bit about time management is to ask yourself, are there little baby steps you can take toward improving the other elements of your life so that you care enough to be a time manager? Second is a second prerequisite before we get to talking about time management tactics is philosophy. The enshrined in the American Declaration of Independence is the pursuit of happiness. And of course, we can pursue happiness simply by, at least I would, if I was all I cared about was happiness, I'd watch Netflix, I'd hang out with my wife, I would go out to eat, I would watch sitcoms. But of course, you may decide that's the right thing we want to do, and so you do the least work you can get away with, and you play. Other people, and that is the conventional feel right now, is work-life balance, and that's fine. But there is a less discussed position which is worth considering as foundational, as a philosophy that would motivate you to really care about making the most of your time, and that is this. You take two human beings, one of whom is specialized, who focuses on work-life balance, works, say, 37 and a half hours a week, and the rest is personal maintenance, family, friends, whatever, meditation. And then you take another person who works 60 or 70 hours a week, and he or she, then those discretionary hours between 37 and a half hours and 65 hours a week, choose to spend it doing what they do well productively. And it could be volunteer work, as in, you know, whatever your favorite cause is, or it could simply be doing your job. And I like, you know, it's obvious, you know, I've used an example before in the show about a cardiologist, a really great cardiologist who's working from hours 40, 37 and a half to 65, and therefore is going to see more patients more quickly and maybe save lives and enable them to see a perhaps better cardiologist than she or he would otherwise get. In my judgment, that person, at least there is a defensible philosophy, that that person who has not only worked more hours, but has squozen as much benefit as he or she can out of that time will make a big difference. And a bigger difference when he or she is dead and you've got the two people and you're, and the god or the goddess or whatever is looking down upon the lives of those two people, the person who ended up deciding to be productive rather than, say, watching movies is going to end up having lived a life better led and perhaps on their deathbed feel better about their life. And of course, that is not the only way. I am more than aware that from Aristotelian times to today, work-life balance has been extolled, but my job is at least to present other options for you to consider. Now I want to turn to perhaps poking a little, that's a little too strong, questioning the current round of time management advice. Now I'm going to turn more to tactics. That current round of time management advice focuses less on hacks and more on, paradoxically, slowing down. And that time management advice reduces to basically two core exhortations. Number one, take more time to think about complex problems so you're more likely to generate better answers. That's the Daniel Kahneman approach, is they call them type one and type two kind of thinking, you know, more impulsive versus reflective. The other core principle of, or core or exhortation in today's time management tends to be to emphasize work-life balance so that your brain will be fresher for subsequent work, and because it's argued that life isn't just about contribution. And those points are often kind of, I'd say, Buddhist-infused, you know, meditate, be mindful, breathe. And predictably, no surprise, that recommendation to muse more and do less has attracted fans. You know, and indeed, it is unarguable that it's wise to take at least a little time to get clear on your life's priorities, your foundational goals, whatever they would be. But in terms of tactics, one size does not fit all. Most of my clients who are making a substantial contribution, as well as good income, actually benefit at least as much, if not more, from those now currently disparaged time hacks, what I'm describing as, perhaps a little hyperbolically, as ways to reap a life and a half from a life. So here are some of those tactics that my successful clients have found most helpful. First of all, avoid major time sucks. For example, lots of TV watching, playing or watching long sports games, going to your second cousin twice removed's far-flung wedding, video games. And I'm saying, we're not talking about little bits, but the people who are spending 3 or 4 hours a day doing these things I'm talking about. Excess food preparation. Delicious, healthy meals can be prepared without a lot of shopping, chopping, and 10-step recipes. Just one example. A breakfast of oatmeal with walnut pieces, dried cranberries, and a teaspoon of brown sugar for breakfast. A salad or a sandwich plus fruit for lunch. And a piece of broiled fish or meat. Seasoned veggies that you steam or microwave even. And yogurt for dessert. Takes almost no time. In shot for chopping or recipe creation. So that's tip one, is being conscious to avoid major time sucks. Two is, and this seems so hard butted, if that's a word, to stay what I call efficiency conscious, keeping a little voice in your ear that's whispering, should I do this now? And if so, what's an efficient way to do it? Not necessarily the fastest way, not necessarily the best way, but the way that yields good benefit per minute. I've found that, you know, and you don't have to do them all the same way. Some tasks I want to do very perfectionistically, either because they're very important or because I enjoy them. Others, I can be slipshod. It really is, I do like the metaphor of the gas pedal, where some tasks you want to go pedal to the metal, and others you want to barely tap on the accelerator. Right? So that staying efficiency conscious is a really potent way to, you know, to improve your time management, to reap, if not a life and a half from a life and a tenth out of a life, or 16 hours out of a 14-hour, or 14 hours out of a 12-hour workday, or 10 hours out of an 8-hour workday. Another tactic that my clients have found helpful is to stay alert to procrastination. Everybody knows they shouldn't, but some people aren't even aware that they're procrastinating. Try to stay alert, and when you're tempted to procrastinate, ask yourself if that's okay. We all need breaks. And if you do decide to do the task now, ask yourself, what is my next 1 second task? For procrastinators, that really helps. Force yourself to do that. What's my next 1 second task? After you've done that one, ask yourself again, what's my next 1 second task? And often, just a few of those 1 second tasks are enough for you to get you rolling. You know, objects in motion tend to stay in motion. And you can use the same technique when you're reaching a hard part in what you're doing. And if you can't figure out what your next 1 second task is, should you get help? Even if it's as basic as doing something what I call the Hey Joe school, turning to somebody in the cube next to you saying, hey Joe, do you know how to solve this? What's beautiful about that, it's free, it's just in time, and that person has context. They work in your workplace, so they may have a better sense of what works in your workplace. The next tactic I want to share is to ritualize. And I'm not talking here about anything spiritual or religious. Whether it's your morning routine or your bedtime routine, or it's a difficult or procrastinatable task that recurs, ritualizing it can really help. Creating a regular set of baby steps, even writing them on a checklist. There's that famous book called The Checklist Manifesto, which find that surgeons who use checklists for their procedures are much less likely to create errors. And once you've created that regular set of baby steps and maybe writing them on a checklist, get in the habit of following that precisely. That is not only effective, but it's comforting to have those routines. And with tasks that you're likely to procrastinate, let's say you want to learn something every day. You want to say, you know what, I really want to be in growth mode. Pair that learning activity with a desired activity. Like, let's say before having dinner, you're going to say, I'm going to allocate 30 minutes to reading or watching instructional videos on YouTube or whatever, and make that inviolate so that you don't need to decide every day whether to do it. And by linking that work task, that is growing, reading or whatever, learning something, and then having dinner, it's motivating. And sometimes it's even better to do that with a person. So let's say you want to do something. Let's say you're trying to learn how to program in Python. It's the basic language for artificial intelligence. And you know that, you know, even if you allocate the 30 minutes a day right before dinner, you're gonna just too often be too tired to do it, not have the bandwidth to do it. But if you make a date every day with a fellow person who also is trying to learn Python, or maybe even a tutor who's trying to teach you Python, and it's scheduled for 30 minutes before dinner, that's going to greatly increase your chances of doing it, and you can see how that would improve your time management. Next is to take micro breaks. Sitting is the new smoking. So, yes, you got to get up out of the chair for a few minutes every hour, because in addition to the health benefits, it does contribute to work-life balance. But there is a quick point of diminishing returns on the length of a break. Sure, when you're stressed, it's worth taking a deep breath or three, a few seconds stretch, 1 minute meditation, whatever. And so are certainly a few minute breaks every hour. But for most people, the cost benefit of those breaks starts to diminish after those few minutes. Of course, there's going to be time you want to take longer breaks. But I'm asking here for consciousness, being aware that really you're reaching a point of diminishing returns when your breaks extend beyond a couple of minutes. I have many more of these which I want to share with you, but you are my priority, and it's all well and good for me to be giving this generic advice. But if you would like advice for yourself regarding your career, whether it be related to some aspect of time management or anything, whether you're unemployed and looking for new work, you're well-employed and still unhappy, thinking about self-employment, want to run your idea by me, you want to tell your story. I love stories. So if you've got a story about something that happened to you at work that might be entertaining and or instructive, all of those are good reasons to call KALW and this show, which is Work with Marty Nemko. The phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Well, I'm waiting for the calls to come in. It's like I said, I do have other time management tips, what I'm hyperbolically calling reaping a life and a half from a life. Think about hiring a personal assistant. Rich people know the benefit of a personal assistant, someone to do the $20 an hour work so they're free to do the $100 an hour work that they could otherwise do, or simply to retain time. I mean, even the rich know they're going to run out of time before running out of money, right? Many middle class or even working class people maybe might also be wise to hire a personal assistant, if only a few hours a week, to handle errands, picking up your kid from school, dropping off your kid at whatever, child care or soccer or whatever, domestic chores, waiting at home for the repair person, so on. Personal assistant. Another one is learn just in time. Courses, let alone degrees, are major time sucks. And much of what gets learned isn't practically relevant, especially if taught in a university. Of course, professors are mainly hired by their first love is research. Or the course is teaching you a mass of stuff so that by the time you need it, you've forgotten it, or it's become obsolete. Of course, credentials often help your career, that MA or even a certificate. But the price in time, as well as money, is often, at least, not worth it, especially if you do keep, as I was mentioning earlier, keep learning on a just-in-time basis. And when you do need to learn something, yeah, ask a coworker, that, quote, Hey Joe school I mentioned, or read an article, or watch a video, attend a webinar, go to a day-long intensive. And if you need proof of your learning, log your learning activities and what you learned from them, the major points, and present those when you are requesting a salary review or in applying for a job. I still have plenty more, but I want to prioritize you. I'm going to go to the phones in a second, but if you have a question or a problem regarding your work life, whether it be related to managing your time, whether you're unemployed, well-employed and unhappy, self-employed or contemplating it, anything related to work, is fair game, as well as stories, something that may have happened to you this week or recently in your work life that might be entertaining or instructive to us. Phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And now to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hi.
Hello.
Oh, hi. Okay, I'm on. Hi, Marty. Hi. Great talking to you. Yeah, the reason I wanted to call you was I want to get some advice about my career. I'm what they call a recharger, so I took a career break for about 7 years, and then the first job that I received after that time was a really exciting job, and I really enjoyed it. I switched into sales, but the only thing is that the salary is really low, and I went ahead and took it because I knew that, you know, I had that career gap.
Sure.
But how would you recommend that I go about asking for a higher salary, even though it's very obvious that, you know, this is the salary that they were giving and the commissions are very low? Everything's very low, even though it's an exciting job.
Now, normally, it's really hard to climb up from a very low salary to anything that's so significant that it's worth staying. Ari, in sales, unfortunately, for better or worse, your worth is determined by your numbers. What are your sales numbers relative to quota?
I mean, yeah, my last review, I was doing 70% above expected performance.
Wow. Can I ask what you're selling?
Pest control.
Okay. You're selling pest control services? Okay. And so the normal best way to get an increase would be to be, and this is a word I use so often, it's vomititious, but it's systematic, to make a list, for starters, of all of the pest control companies that have excellent Yelp reviews. You don't want to be selling a product that's sleazy. You want to find the ones that have really great satisfied customers that are in a reasonable geographic distance from your home, because commute times can take the soul out of anybody. So you look at the ones that are in your geographic area, and you either, if you're more comfortable by phone or in writing, you make the following pitch. I did take a 7-year break to whatever, recharge, whatever you want to say, recognizing that with that kind of a break, what was most important was for me to get my first job, so I have something on my resume to prove that I'm back in the business, I'm back in, you know, in full function. Well, fortunately, I did take a job for a pest control company, and I exceed my quota by 70%, but their pay, their commission schedule is terrible. And so I'm looking elsewhere to leverage my skills in knowing about the pest control industry. And I'm wondering if you might need a good salesperson. If you do that, again, systematically to 3, 4, or 5 of the highest Yelp-rated companies in your geographic area, there's a good chance they'll say, no, we have nothing. Or they'll ignore you. Today's rejection method is ignoring. But if you then circle back once a month, there is always a need for good salespeople. And I would bet that within 2-3 months, if not immediately, you could look out and the first phone call you make, they say, you are manna from heaven. You're exactly what we needed. But if you treat it as not a marathon, but an intermediate distance race that might require you circling back 2 or 3 or 4 times, I am betting, given your track record, that you will be able, that'll get you a much better chance of getting a good salary. And you know, you may or may not need to accept the first offer. If, in fact, you're going to be generating, let's say, $1 million or $500,000 in revenue and maybe $200,000 in net profit, they should be paying you pretty darn well, not paying you a crapola. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, the thing is that I'm an engineer by background, so I really want to get back to where I came from, which is engineering and, you know, technology. And obviously, I'm not in that field right now, but I do enjoy the sales side of things. So do you think I have an opportunity to get back into sales? I mean, to go back to engineering and start all fresh and new in sales?
I would absolutely try it. I would try two approaches. I would try it. Why? You know, you have nothing to lose by trying. So I would certainly make a list of the you know, there's engineering and there's engineering. There's everything from software engineering to civil engineering to plastics engineering. So I would take wherever my expertise was best, and I would query their sales manager and say the truth. I had to get back in. I'm an engineer. I needed to get a job right away because of my, you know, long absence. I was grateful to get any job. Look how well I've done in sales, but now I want to leverage that to use my engineering skills. And if you make that pitch five times and they all laugh at you or ignore you, then you can go to plan B and decide, okay, maybe I need an intermediate step and I need to stay in the industry of pest control until I get a higher salary, and then maybe I'll be seen as having a better track record at a higher rate of compensation. So certainly, why not try? You have nothing to lose. Try the engineering sales route, and if that doesn't work, go the pest control route, but get a higher salary. What's your reaction to that?
That sounds good. Also, when it comes to pest control, I am like basically at the best company out there. So okay. I don't think I really want to look at the competitors, but how would I go about asking my current employer for a raise?
Okay, good. Fair question. The way I would do it is I would document. I would do, you know, not just your sales record, because that's pretty obvious, but I would say something like the following. I would, for my private self, first of all, I'd list all the ways in which I added value to the company. Number one, maybe I added esprit de corps. Maybe I used my engineering advice to help the field guys solve difficult problems. Maybe they've got a very bad, I'm making this up, but let's say you're a construction engineer and there's been powder post beetles and termites affecting the bearing walls, and you were helping them solve the problem because you're an engineer. Including those anecdotes or anything you've done in addition to your sales quota, putting that in writing and saying something like, it appears that I have netted the company X dollars, roughly, and that look at my compensation and it has not gotten a raise. It therefore seems that in light of that, as well as, and maybe there are salary surveys that are available through the industry association or whatever, to find out what other salespeople are making, or maybe you could ask some other salespeople at competitors, even if you want to work for them, so you've got some comparable data, and you present to them that in a professional way, and that's your best shot of staying within the company.
And okay, what's your normal process? Like, how long should you be at a company before you ask for a raise? Because I've only been there about 6 months.
That's plenty enough for me. If you've beaten quo, yes. If you have beaten the quo, yeah, because the longer you stay, the more you're subtly telling them that you'll take that crappy wage. No. In fact, my way, if you were my client and you had done well for 3 months and produced really well, I would have gone right up right there, so lest they think they take you for granted. No. 6 months is not too early at all.
Oh, okay. So what are you asking for, a 20% increase, or what are you trying to ask for?
It depends on what would the goddess say. If there was a goddess who was looking down what's fair to the company and fair to you, would the goddess say you deserve 20% more, 50% more, 10% more? And that would be based on how much money you're really bringing into the company, especially if you're, you know, over what the average schnook would do, given that you yielded 70% more than what was expected, geez, that seems like it's worth a hell of a lot of a raise.
Yeah. So what would you approximate about what is a hell of a lot of a raise?
Again, like, it depends on how
more?
Maybe I would probably ask for 30% more.
Okay,
I would say something like, I took this because I had taken a 7-year break to prove myself. I've now worked for you for 6 months. I've proven myself by well exceeding expectations. I've made this amount of money for you, and I'm all, you know, and these are the other ways I've added value beyond my quota. So now I want to be paid closer to fair market value, which would be X, 30% more than you're making.
Okay, that's perfect. And this should all be done in writing, you think?
It depends on the human being. I am, you know, if you're more comfortable doing it verbally, you should do it verbally. If you're more comfortable putting it in writing, do it in writing. The most standard approach is to say, to request an appointment with your boss. So they can, by making an appointment, your boss knows you're taking it seriously. Then when the appointment is set, you email him and say, in preparation for the meeting, I wanted to send you this. So that he can see it in advance and he's not getting you know, sandbagged with it. And then you go and you meet with him to discuss it. That's the standard approach.
Okay, perfect. I appreciate your help. This has been very helpful.
That's my job. It's my pleasure. It's my pro bono work, but it is my pleasure to do it, and I thank you for calling Work with Marty Nemco.
Okay, thanks a lot, Marty.
Take care.
Have a great day. Bye.
Bye. Give out the phone number again. If you've got a work-related problem, I've been doing this now 29 and a quarter years. I've heard it all, and frankly, the harder the problem, the better. Both for me, because it's more interesting, but more importantly, it's for you, the listeners, because if you can hear me help you solve a really hard problem, it gives you the most important thing of all, hope. So, whatever your problem, as long as it's related to work, the phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco and KALW, 415 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I'm going to go back to the phones in a minute, but I want to make sure that I'm giving you these time management tips before we deviate from that. So here's another one that my clients have found invaluable, and that is to have what I call a sponge activity at the ready. We all have dead times during the day, like when we're commuting, or we're taking a walk or jogging, or waiting in line or in a waiting room. Just get into the habit of having a productive activity to sponge up that waiting time. And that could be, for example, I use this all the time, a professional or personal development audiobook that's on my phone, or it's in my car. And if it's in my car, I'm not only making good use of the commute time, it's distracting me from the crazy stress of gridlock that I'm in. It seems like no matter when I, even on the weekends, if I'm on 80 or 101, I'm in gridlock. So there's so many benefits of having that sponge activity. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Namco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you? Hello.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi. So I have an upcoming event that I'm going to attend, and I'm a little bit nervous that a former manager who was less than pleasant to work with will be attending as well. And, you know, I've done a little research in how you should handle these situations. I don't know if they will be there, but just in case, I thought maybe I'd get some advice from you on sort of how to handle that situation. And I'm a little bit nervous that, you know, she may engage me.
So, this one's pretty easy, I think. You take the lead. The strong thing to do is, the first thing you do is you put on your friendly, not silly, not salesman smile look, but you come in with a pleasant look on your face. You approach her and you say, "Hi, Mary, good to see you. How are you? How are you?" Just obligatory. And then here is the secret. As quickly as is possible, without, while still retaining some social graces, you stick your hand out and shake her hand and say, "Good seeing you," and you walk away. And you say, "I got to go to the bathroom, I got to go get food, I got to go, you know, whatever." But that way you're preempting the problem, so you're not standing tortured the entire time waiting for her to come in. By you taking control, you're approaching her at the moment when you're most confident, rather than waiting when she may approach you when you're feeling insecure.
Right. Perfect. Yeah. No, that's great. Okay.
Thanks for calling Work with Marty Namco.
Thank you.
Okay. Phone number again if you've got a work-related problem of any sort, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. What's that the number for? What I call a workover. Here at KELW, my pro bono work, no pummeling is involved. Usually, every once in a while, I have to be tough. I like that. I prefer to be kind, but if tough is going to be more helpful, you'll get that from me, too. 415-841-4134. Back to time management tips. I was just speaking about commuting and gridlock. By design, the government is building fewer freeways for ostensible environmental benefit, even though all that pollution is spewing out of the tailpipes. But it certainly lengthens driving commutes for everybody with 100% certitude. And yet, mass transit is usually more time-consuming still. Where I live, you know, I live in Oakland, many people around here, or certainly those who live out in the suburbs, you know, further away like Walnut Creek, let alone Antioch, spend 2 or more hours every day. I have a client who lives in Pleasanton. He has to commute into San Francisco in the far place. You know, he doesn't live near the BART station, so he's got to, he would have to drive to BART, find a non-existent parking spot in the BART, in the Pleasanton BART parking lot, take that into the city to, I think it's the Glen Park station, and then he'd have to walk a long way or wait for a bus or take an Uber and then reverse that in the back. So it's a nightmare. Well, what I encourage many of my clients to do is to try to convince their employer to let them telecommute 1 or 2 or 3 days a week. 5 is risky because out of sight is out of mind. You then don't develop the relationships or get the inside information or can collaborate as well, and you therefore greatly increase your risk of getting laid off. So, but 1 or 2 or 3 days a week of telecommuting can save you not only a ton of time, not only a ton of gas money and BART money and bus money and Uber money, but it can save your stress, because if you know some people who have, if you've taken 2 hours in the morning to get from Concord to San Francisco, by the time you get there, you're already half burned out for the day. And that's something you can also explain to your employer. You're going to get a better employee if you're having me work at home. And if you're worried that I'm going to be, you know, watching sitcoms all day or soap operas, I'd be happy to be communicating with you as much as you want by email, phone, or Skype, send you my work products, have accountability reports, and certainly let's try it on a trial basis. If after a week you don't like it, we can change it. That becomes kind of an irresistible job, irresistible offer. An offer that's tough to refuse. So I think the telecommuting is a particularly good way to save lots and lots of time and stress. And finally, taking what I call mini vacations. That, you know, that 8 days, 7 night, let alone 2 week long vacations, may be more for the travel packager's benefit than your benefit. Think about it. Preparing for a long vacation takes a lot of time, it's a lot of stress. And then when you return, you're usually facing a mountain of stuff that you got to do. A mountain of emails, voicemails, and just paper. Day trips and overnights tend to be yielding the most time benefit. For most people, it's wiser to have 14 of those, either staycations or one-day vacations or overnights during a year, than 2 week-long vacations. We're all tempted to jump on, this is kind of a summary statement here, we're all tempted to jump on the exhortation du jour. And that tends to be, when we're talking about time management as in 2018, that tends to be exhortations for work-life balance, meditation, and so on. Yeah, I'm not saying it doesn't yield benefit, but it's certainly wise in my judgment to not ignore the less au courant, the less lofty, but often helpful time hacks that have helped my clients and me. And now I'll give out the phone number again. If you've got a work-related problem of any sort, the phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco for a workover, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. That's if you got a problem, you got a story, self-employment idea, anything related to work, 415-841-4134. I want to extend past time management per se to something that I call the Peter Pan syndrome. I want to start by telling a little story. The smartest kid in my high school, his name was, I'll just say Stephen. I don't know, he may be not be proud of this, but anyway, the smartest kid in my high school dropped out of high school. Why? He dropped out to become a good humor ice cream truck driver. And I have to admit, even though I'm one of these, you know, very driven, work-oriented people, there's a little piece of me that, I mean, we all thought he was crazy, you know, for doing that. But there's a little piece of me now, decades later, that wonder if there isn't some wisdom in that. Because he was a really smart self-learner, and he did plenty of learning on his own, but as a good humor ice cream driver, he, without any ethical compromise or taking courses he hated or spending a fortune on college or graduate school, with guaranteed he helped every kid find joy. Because when that musical bell from the Good Humor ice cream truck came, the kids were excited. They were delighted. You know that look on kids' faces. And so I want to, this is a preface to saying, I am not unaware that there isn't a rational argument that can be made for not being a driven workaholic person. But I've also found that that kind of is the exception. And there are a heck of a lot of smart people who don't want to be good humor drivers, but still fail. It's what I call the Peter Pan syndrome. Many of my clients, they come to me thinking they'd be successful if only they had an idea for a more exciting career. But in fact, their lack of success more often is caused by what I'm calling the Peter Pan syndrome. They won't grow up. And I'm going to describe its manifestations and some cures in a few minutes. But again, I'd like to prioritize you, my dear listeners. So let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you? Hello. Are you
Hello.
There? Hi.
Hi. I actually was looking for some very concrete advice about how to take your advice about hiring a personal assistant.
Okay.
Because my one attempt to do so sort of felt more like a full-time job.
Oh, geez. Okay. So, do you need to tell me anything more, or should I start to hold forth?
I work very full time. I love my job. I have a painful commute, but I really like what I do, and I want to free up some time in my personal life.
Of course you do. Okay. So, Norm, you know, it is a very intimate relationship between your personal assistant and you. So it's generally true for almost all hires, but especially for a personal assistant, to have somebody who you can implicitly trust, not just not to steal from you, but we all have secrets. We all have private information that we don't want rumored around. So normally your best shot at getting such a person is by emailing or phoning every person whom you know in your life whom you respect. And you say, I am looking for a trustworthy person to do A, B, and C. List the main tasks. Don't get too perfectionistic about this. What really counts is the major things that you would want done, as well as the major personality characteristics that you want, and say, is there anybody who you yourself would hire for such a position? That is your best shot of getting a quality person. Have you done that? Maybe you've done that already, but...
No, I haven't.
How does that... Trust your intuition. Does your intuition tell you that that would work for you?
Seems like a good place to start.
Awesome. Thanks very much for calling Work with Marty Nemco.
Thank you.
Okay, phone number again. I love the range. The diversity of work problems are just fun for me, and I think probably for you, my dear listeners. So whatever your work-related problem, I'm happy to try to help. The phone number here at KELW and Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. So before I took the call, I was explaining that many of my clients come to me thinking they'd be successful if they just had another idea for a more exciting career. But in fact, their lack of success is more often caused by what I call the Peter Pan syndrome. They won't grow up. So here are the Peter Pan syndrome's most common manifestations. The first is an unwillingness to get working or stay working when you're not motivated to. If you're only willing to work hard when you feel like it, you're not going to feel like it often enough. Working hard has got to be something that you do. It's not a decision to make. It's foundational. You say, this is important both for a sense of contribution, for money, to not feel like I'm a shirker. You know, it's just making that a non-decision is a critical cure to the Peter Pan syndrome. Second core cause or manifestation of the Peter Pan syndrome is dabbling. Being unwilling to stay focused on becoming sufficiently expert at something. Believe me, I understand it's fun to dabble because we quickly reach a point of diminishing returns whenever we're learning something new. You know, we've learned something and now it's starting to be hard or redundant or whatever. And so it's tempting to say, okay, I've learned enough about that, I'm going to the next thing. But when we're talking about making a living, there are very few employers who are willing to pay for dabblers. And yeah, again, there's always exceptions. A brilliant person can achieve excellence in many areas, but most people can't. And so people who suffer from the Peter Pan syndrome, not growing up, they generally just can't resist the dabbling, and therefore they always have a hard time staying employed. So pick something that you care about. And, you know, it's like that Malcolm Gladwell book, you know, with saying you need 10,000 hours to become expert. It may or may not take that. I don't believe in these necessarily rules of thumb. But you might well be advised to pick something and say, I am going to stay focused on this for a while. I'm going to do a deep dive in this, something that is interesting but is also marketable enough. You know, like I'm interested right now, I'm doing a deep dive into India. I like watching movies about India. I'm reading books about India. I'm interested, but it ain't going to make me a living. But I don't care. But if I were needing to make a living, I would focus, and let's say I cared about India, I would focus on some little aspect of India that was something that could be marketable for me. Maybe the career counseling profession in India and where there are gaps, and really do a deep dive to that so I was really an expert at how I could become an excellent career counselor in India or to East Indians. Okay, next. Another manifestation of the Peter Pan syndrome is betting on long shot dreams. And this makes me a little self-conscious. Because I don't like to pour water on people's dreams. I really don't. Who would want to do that? But long-shot dreams like becoming a self-supporting actor, an artist, documentary filmmaker, sports marketer, environmental activist, fashion executive, whatever. Yeah, obviously, some people have achieved those goals and make at least a decent living. But unless you're an unusually talented and driven person, ideally with great connections, your chances are small. And yet some people cling to their long shot dream, sometimes as an excuse for not doing the work that they need to do to launch a more realistic career. Make sure that's not you. I mean, I just last night, I don't even remember the context, but I was speaking to a woman who was, you know, sick of working for nonprofits because she, environmental nonprofits, she's a committed environmentalist, but they insist on her working as a volunteer. Or if they're going to pay her, they're going to pay her crap for long, long hours to do work that isn't very fun. So it's sad, but, you know, one of the standard models of being able to keep your values while not going broke is the Bill Gates model. You do your day job, you make your money where there's money to be made, say software, and then you donate zillions of dollars, in Bill Gates' case, or you donate your time to your environmental cause after work. So betting on long-shot dreams tends to be a manifestation of this kind of dreamy Peter Pan syndrome and a refusal to grow up, while fully acknowledging that some people say, you know what, I do not want to compromise. I am going to make a living as an environmental activist, and if I have to be unemployed for 3 years until I do, I will keep looking. Those are intimate personal choices about how you live your life, but it's a factor that needs to be considered. Most obvious, a manifestation of the Peter Pan syndrome or not willing refusal to grow up is abusing alcohol or drugs. I'm not going to go into a lecture, but you know what I mean. And there's too many people we know, especially now with marijuana legal. By the way, so many of the people who I know who do use marijuana, they're not buying it legally because it's so expensive and so bizarrely packaged that they're still using their dealer. So all these supposed tax revenues that are going to come in are not coming in, but I digress. But certainly part of Peter Pan syndrome is people who abuse alcohol or drugs. Another manifestation is the Peter Pan syndrome, is blaming your failure on something that your parents did, your spouse did, your former employer did. I mean, there were many people who were terribly abused, and I'm talking now about all races, certainly from African Americans who were slaves, to the Irish immigrants who were placed in indentured servitude in the Southeast, to the Chinese in the early 20th century who were treated inhumanely as railroad workers, to the Japanese who were placed in internment camps, to the, of course, the Jewish Holocaust survivors. Both my parents were that, you know, and they managed to triumph. And many people are blaming their failures on something far less dramatic than what their parents did. They ignored them, they said they were dumb or whatever, or their spouse left them, or their employer fired them unfairly, and they're continuing to blame their failure. That is maybe the most common manifestation of the Peter Pan syndrome. They really deep down refuse to grow up and move forward, and so they're always blaming something on, they're blaming their lack of success on anything but themselves. One more. A final reason, not sexy at all, why some smart people fail, why they are guilty of manifesting the Peter Pan syndrome, is that they do an insufficiently thorough job search. Here's what a thorough job search really looks like, a grown-up job search, not a Peter Pan syndrome job search. They identify 50 people who are not advertising an on-target job, but who have the power to hire you for your target job or to create one for you. You may find them in LinkedIn or through your personal network or whatever, but 50 people not advertising, so you're not competing with 10 zillion people. And then you not only pitch yourself to them, but you make the effort to build a relationship with them over months, because it's unlikely right at that moment that they're either going to care enough about you or have a job for you at that moment. So you make the longer-term commitment to getting them to care enough about you, believe in you, and for enough time to have transpired so that they may have a job for you. Also, you've got to regularly contact your extended personal network, not just the 3 or 4 people who are obvious choices, your best friend, your spouse, your lover, whatever, the parents, but your extended network, because that extended network, if they really do like you, is more likely to have a job. If there's 50 people in your extended network and only 5 in your immediate network, those 45 are more likely to have leads for you or jobs for you than your core 5. But the Peter Pan syndrome sufferer doesn't do that. They make their 3 or 4 queries to their connections, and that's it. You've got to have a good LinkedIn profile, absolutely, including a really good picture that shows you professionally with a smile and it is not grainy. You've got to craft, in when you are answering ads, you can't just send slam together, you know, the one generic answer. You've got to craft lots of top-of-the-heap job applications that show point by point how you meet the requirements for the job at a level of quality that's impressive. And you've also need to include collateral material such as a white paper, you know, like the 7 keys to effective nonprofit fundraising in the year 2019, if that's the kind of career you're going for, a portfolio of your work. And then you need to make substantive follow-ups after the job interview, not just an obligatory thank you letter, but a mini business plan, for example, what you would do if you were hired. That's what a thorough job search looks like. That's what it takes to get, not to get a crap job. You know, we have the lowest unemployment rate now in 50 years. So it's not hard to find a job, but a decent job does require that kind of effort. And the people who suffer from the Peter Pan syndrome do not do that. And so they're complaining about, oh, man, you know, the unemployment statistics are misleading. It's not really 3.7%. There's a whole lot of bad. You know, it's true. The unemployment rate's somewhat misleading. There's a lot of people who have given up and are underemployed working for crap wages. But they're in this job market, which is better than it's been in a long time for sure. By doing that thorough job search, which is antithetical to the mindset of what people with the Peter Pan syndrome manifest yourself, you've got the best shot you've had in years of landing a good job. So, might any of those Peter Pan syndrome behaviors apply to you? As I said, I'll quickly go over them again. An unwillingness to get working or stay working when you're not motivated. Dabbling. Betting on long shot dreams. Abusing alcohol or drugs. Blaming your failure on something your parents, spouse, or former employer did to you. Doing an insufficiently thorough job search. Do any of those apply to you if you're really being honest with yourself? And if so, is that a wake-up call? Or do you want to accept that at least at this point in your life, you just don't care enough about career success to make the now usually required effort to land a good job? Unfortunately, today, at least more than ever in my 30 years as a career counselor, I am finding, you know, with this so much part-timing and temping and automation, that unless you're lucky, you know, some people just get lucky, of course, luck matters, or you're brilliant, landing and keeping a good job really does require you to be a grown-up, that is, to not suffer with the Peter Pan syndrome. Give out the phone number again if you've got a work-related problem of any sort. Unemployed, whether you're 16 or 76, unemployed or well-employed and still unhappy, self-employed, public sector, government employee, nonprofit employee, for-profit employee, large company, all I care about is you got a problem that's annoying you about your work life or someone you care about. I'll try to help. The phone number, 415-841-4134. That's the number here at Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. Okay. Now I want to turn to a quite different angle, which is there are many people who have a bachelor's degree but haven't yet chosen a career. I've had 5,500 career counseling clients now, and I have kind of, in preparing for this show, I made a list of what the average bachelor's degree holders actually do. And I'm going to share those with you, and that may help you in choosing a career if you've got a bachelor's or even a master's degree. But again, I want to prioritize you. So let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hello. Am I on the air?
You are.
Oh, hi. My name is Diane, and I have landed in a job situation which it's exciting. It's really, really, really hard. And I was referred by friend slash acquaintance, and what I'm doing is live in caregiving, where I live in the home with the person who needs the care.
Right.
And I don't have a lot of privacy because my room is in the middle of the house.
Right.
It does not have its own separate door. So setting limits is one thing to avoid burnout, compassion fatigue, and what I'm dealing with is a cross-addicted person who's ill because of their lifestyle and habits.
Right.
And that affects their behavior, and I live in the middle of it. Now, what I'm discovering, which actually is really stimulating and exciting for me, is I do all the cooking and menu planning and shopping and no, like, intimate personal care, but I nonetheless encounter things that a lot of people would turn their nose up at, and I just do them. I complain, but I do them.
Right.
And what I'm finding is that there are a ton of people from 50 on up in the Bay Area who are falling through the cracks, who don't have family and or friends, or they're isolated because they're lying to their friends.
Yep.
And their families maybe are in the Midwest or farther away, and they don't really know how bad it is.
Right.
And what I see myself operating as is sort of a one-woman SWAT team. And I come into these homes. Some people own these homes. Some people, you know, some of these places are apartments, condos, custom homes.
Absolutely.
And they could be reported to APS and the public health department.
So what's your question? You know, it's a story I've heard. What's your, so what, do you have a question for me?
Yeah, like I'm seeing that I see like there's this big, huge need.
Yep.
And I have a lot of empathy and I have a lot of skills. And I know how to deal. I mean, I'm not perfect, but I deal with people who are cross-addicted. I feel like there's a huge need for what I do, and I feel like I'd like to have more live-works situations ongoing for years and help more people and do it in a way that it doesn't kill me and burn me out and make me bitter.
So if you're my sister or daughter, I would tell you the following.
What?
You know, there is this tremendous need for personal chefs, for people who are ill or have special dietary needs, who have diabetes or whatever. And if it's burning you out to do this other stuff, you're willing to do it, but you don't sound like you're old. You want to say you want to do this for a couple of decades.
Well, not all the gnarly personal care and battling with addiction. I'd like to do, you know, the live-in personal
chef. Well, that's what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, so to keep you, you know, long-term from burning out, I would be marketing myself not as the caretaker for people with this level of problems, but as the personal chef who might additionally do some things so you become beloved. But by branding yourself as the personal live-in chef for people whose lives are overwhelmed and doing minor tasks, not the, like I understand, the cleaning the crap, you know, from their diapers and whatever. I understand. But I think by focusing, by marketing, there's something called, there's two. There's the U.S. Personal, United States Personal Chef Association, and then there's another one, I don't remember the name. But marketing yourself that way, and then, but differentiating yourself not just by being just a cook, that you're willing to do some of the other stuff, that would seem to be a plan for longevity rather than primarily marketing yourself as a caretaker. Does that make sense?
Exactly, because I want to get to Puerto Vallarta, you know, and live in the apartment building that the person who needs me to be their chef owns. That's what I want.
Yeah. So, you know, whether it's there are places, for example, that serve well, it doesn't have to be drug addicted people. It could be anybody that's serving that. For example, you know, I live fairly near Rossmore, which is a large development of retirees that have scaled level of care from full independence to full memory care and the like. I'm wondering, you know, if there you find a place where there is, you know, what city do you live in?
San Francisco currently.
Okay. So, you know, there are facilities, as I've driven around, there are large senior developments. I would probably, I'd probably very basically, whether it be on their online newsletter or simply flyers that you'd hang up on bulletin boards in those areas, sell yourself as a personal chef who also will do some additional caretaking tasks and live in wanted. And I think that's your best approach to not burning out and getting to do the part of the job that you say is exciting, but not burnout prone.
Yeah, and just make it clear and have better boundaries. Yeah, that makes all
exactly
all good sense.
Right, and you need privacy. Some of these care. You have to have a life. If that privacy means
not having it,
right, we can't. That's not a way to live. You're not asking for anything unreasonable here. So, you know, you can in your ad simply say private room required
or something like that. Private room, you know, private room in the house required. In life in general, it's critical to ask for what you want. Well, something I'll never forget. At Harvard University, at the orientation, when there's one, it changes, of course, depending on who the tour guide is, who the orientation guide is, or whatever. But something that is always said is the key to success at Harvard is to ask for what you want. And when they say no, ask somebody else. And that asking for what you want, as long as it's ethical, is so core to the life well led. And what you're talking about here is a perfect manifestation. You're not asking for anything unreasonable. Ask for what you want, and when they say no, in other words, when you get no response from one set of queries, try another. And if you look, you know, like somebody who's would be indeed a nice caretaker, put a picture in there. We all relate well to the visual. The human species is a visual species. So putting your picture on either the job ad, the ad, or on the flyer, may be a way to create an emotional connection with somebody that make it more likely to get hired. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'll put a photo of me cooking.
Perfect. Perfect. All right. I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling Work with Marty Nemco. Okay. We're not going to have time to talk about, I was going to talk about, for millions of people who have a bachelor's or even a master's degree, but haven't chosen a career. And I've inventoried what my clients have done in the real world, not some theoretical how-to book, what you should do, what my clients have actually done. But I'm going to save that for next week because it's going to take a little more time. I just want to offer a tip that's pretty important. This is a kind of a worker advocate kind of a tip that I want to end with. Many people don't realize that it's unlawful for private sector employers to prohibit employees from discussing wages and compensation. If having an open discussion of salaries among your peers and coworkers can help ensure that you're getting paid fairly. There are many people, to be really honest, some people, women and people of color, feel they're being underpaid relative to their work. Well, whatever your race or gender, knowing what other people are earning helps ensure that you get paid fairly. And yet many people, apart from, people just choose to not discuss it because money is so and I got this idea from the New York Times, I must admit, recently on the 19th of this month. Money is so tied up with complex and difficult emotions like shame and success, fear of failure, how people view you. You know, you may feel embarrassed to say you're low paid or highly paid. You may feel ashamed, like you're bragging or that you're overpaid or whatever. But it really is, it's both within the law allowable, and ethically it's fairer in terms of we don't want to put all the power in the employer to not know what is the prevailing wage in your workplace. So I encourage you to do that. Maybe start with somebody who's more senior than you, maybe who helped bring you on, maybe a previous manager, somebody else you really trust who wants to see you succeed. Right? And that can be very helpful. And also, of course, the old-fashioned LinkedIn, Payscale, and Salary.com can also be good resources to find a baseline. Anyway, that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Thursday at 7. You can call in for workover, plus a debate from two really strong people on both sides of this debate. Is universal basic income a good idea? I'll talk with Mark Joffe and Andrew Yang. Andrew Yang is already running for president of the United States in the Democratic Party, and his main thing is universal basic income. And Mark Joffe was a guy who was an analyst at Moody's Investment Service. It'll be a great debate. Until then, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.